Hello, I'm David Coquel, head of the US Compensation Research Team at ISS, and I would like to welcome everyone to the June installment of the ISS Proxy Bulletin podcast series for the Americas region. In this podcast, we will provide a recap of the executive compensation trends and highlights that we saw for the 2020 US and Canadian proxy seasons. We will also provide a glimpse of some things to be on the lookout for during next year's proxy season, particularly as so many companies have made or expect to make changes to their pay programs in response to the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. Joining me to talk today about compensation are a trio of ISS's pay experts: Brett Miller, head of data solutions for ISS ESG; Rashima Kathuria, a senior member of the Canadian Compensation Research Team; and Galen Spielman, a senior member of the US Compensation Research Team. All right, let's kick off the discussion in the US with Galen. How are 2020 SANPay approval levels faring as we wrap up the US season?
Well, David, looking at vote results for firms in the S&P 500 index, we have seen 8 say-on-pay failures for votes held prior to Memorial Day weekend, including CVS Health, Intel, and Qualcomm. Now, this is double 2019's count of failed proposals over the same period. Given the number of failed votes, it's apparent that companies are not insulated from failed votes simply by virtue of their market cap or broad shareholder base. Now, a total of 21 companies in the S&P 500 received less than 70% support, which is generally in line with the prior year. Across the broader Russell 3000 index, the failure rate so far is roughly in line with prior years, between 2 and 2.5%.
And Galen, have you noticed any trends among those companies that received relatively low say-on-pay support?
Well, some boards are still having a hard time saying goodbye to exiting executives. In a concerning trend that has carried over from last year's proxy season, we identified several instances of problematic severance arrangements at companies in the S&P 500 and Russell 3000 indexes. Now, these cost-say arrangements most often consisted of a company either paying significant severance to former executives despite public filings that suggested a voluntary resignation or retirement, or providing enhanced termination payments or benefits beyond what was provided for under existing employment agreements or severance plans. We continue to hear that many investors believe severance is generally inappropriate in the wake of voluntary terminations, and that clear disclosure of the true nature of the termination is important for shareholders to be able to assess the appropriateness of severance payments. Now, one motivation for some companies' reluctance to disclose involuntary terminations appears to stem from boards' desire to allow executives who would otherwise face involuntary terminations to make somewhat of a more graceful exit. These types of face-saving gestures, though, inhibit investors' ability to assess the appropriateness of these severance arrangements. Now, investors appear to have expressed their concerns surrounding these problematic severance arrangements when voting on say-on-pay proposals, as we identified some form of problematic severance arrangement at roughly one quarter of the S&P firms that received relatively low support for say-on-pay.
Any specific example you could share with us?
One such company that comes to mind is Altria Group. In this case, the board's compensation committee approved sizable cash payments for both the former CEO and the former chief strategy and growth officer as replacements for equity awards they forfeited in connection with their apparent disclosed voluntary resignations. Now, in the case of Altria, the say-on-pay proposal failed to receive majority support.
Okay, so severance is certainly a key issue. Were there any other noticeable pay trends across one or more industries or sectors to speak of?
Well, I would say in recent years, many investors have expressed heightened concerns over pay programs that place a significant reliance on committee discretion to determine pay levels. Now, fortunately, companies' responses to these concerns have resulted in a multi-industry shift towards more objective and transparent pay programs and imposition of more limitations and disclosures on the application of committee discretion. Now, unfortunately, several large-cap issuers in the financial services and banking sectors continue to tie all, or at least a significant portion of pay, to some form of discretionary assessment rather than objective financial or other transparent metrics. Now, when these companies exhibit a pay-for-performance misalignment, there's an inherent subjectivity in the discretionary assessments, which limits investors' ability to assess the linkage between pay and performance. Now, one company in which we identified significant concerns over discretionary determinations and limited transparency into pay decisions is Capital One. For the most recently completed performance year, total CEO pay was determined based on a discretionary performance assessment framework without the use of any preset target goals or individually weighted metrics. While disclosed target pay opportunities provided some insight into pay determinations for the year in review, the compensation committee eliminated the use of a target pay opportunity for the CEO for the upcoming performance year, which further limited investors' ability to assess pay relative to performance. Capital One and Invesco, which maintains a similar pay program structure, each received less than 70% shareholder support for say on pay and will be subject to a responsiveness policy next year. Now, notably, two other large financial companies with similar highly discretionary pay programs, Goldman Sachs and State Street, received just over 70% support.
Okay, and Gil, let me ask you about founder-led companies where CEOs may receive nominal pay in light of their substantial existing ownership. Are these companies facing investor scrutiny even when CEO pay may be minimal?
Well, you know, David, since the say on pay proposal covers the CEO, CFO, and the three other most highly compensated executives, the CEO's pay alone really doesn't provide the complete picture. In fact, there were several instances where our closer inspection of the pay program for non-CEO named executive officers revealed poor practices. One high-profile example of this situation is Tesla. Now, in 2019, Elon Musk received actually less than $30,000 in pay, consisting solely of a minimum wage salary for less than half of the year. This small salary payout, of course, follows Musk's record-setting multi-billion dollar moonshot award, which was previously approved by Tesla shareholders. While Musk's modest salary was unlikely to raise any eyebrows, a review of the pay programs for Tesla's other named executive officers showed sizable equity awards that lacked performance vesting conditions. Now, based on ISS's valuation, Zach Kirkhorn received nearly $25 million in time vesting equity awards in connection with his internal promotion to the role of CFO, which, in addition to his 2019 award, brought the total value of his equity awards to more than double the median total pay of ISS-selected peer CEOs. Speaking of Musk, it's also worth noting that his pay has remained a hot topic in 2020, as the first tranche of his multi-billion dollar performance stock option granted in 2019 recently vested upon the achievement of market capitalization and revenue milestones. Now, notably, this milestone was reached despite the company remaining unprofitable. A similar example is Facebook. CEO Mark Zuckerberg does not participate in the company's annual or long-term incentive programs, which has historically resulted in modest reported pay values. As with Tesla, though, we identified significant concerns regarding the pay programs for other Facebook NEOs, as award determinations were largely discretionary and large equity awards lacked performance conditions. Specifically, each non-CEO NEO received $20 million in time vesting equity awards, and the proxy lacked disclosure of specific accomplishments considered by the board when determining the magnitude of these awards. While his pay is low, Facebook reported security costs of over $20 million for Zuckerberg as well, which is several times larger than the typical security costs for S&P 500 CEOs.
Well, speaking of Facebook, recently there has been some media attention on the pay programs at some high-profile technology, media, and telecom companies. What's the reason for this?
Well, I would say in the past, nominal CEO pay levels have masked the explosion of pay for other named executive officers at some of these high-profile firms. Now, as a result, our team has made a concerted effort to evaluate the quality of pay programs for all top executives at these firms, even where the CEO earns relatively little. In addition to Facebook, a recent example that comes to mind here is Viacom CBS's Joe Iannello. Now, following the high-profile merger between the two companies, a provision in Iannello's agreement allowed him to receive nearly $80 million in severance payments after entering into a new employment agreement following the merger. This was in addition to receiving a large inducement award valued at over $20 million. Now, notwithstanding these and other significant concerns identified in our report, the say-on-pay proposal received over 95% support. I would say it's worth noting that in the case of Viacom CBS and some other high-profile TMT companies, say-on-pay vote results may not tell the entire story about shareholder and investor views of a company's pay program. This is because some of the largest companies in the TMT sector maintain dual class voting structures. These structures insulate board members and executives from poor say on pay vote results.
Sure, and that situation certainly highlights one of the major problems that investors encounter at companies with unequal voting rights. Okay, well, turning now to board compensation, any noticeable trends to note for the 2020 proxy season?
Well, David, I would say director pay is one area where, you know, I'm happy to report some good news. The 2020 season marked the second year for our policy on excessive non-employee director pay and the first year for potential adverse vote recommendations under this policy. ISS identifies instances of outlier levels of director pay and assesses whether the company disclosed the reasonable rationale for the high pay level under this policy. Now, fortunately, during the 2020 proxy season, we identified several instances in which companies either provided enhanced disclosure of the rationale for outlier pay levels or made year-over-year improvements to their board compensation programs. One positive example that comes to mind here is Ross Stores. For the second consecutive year, Chairman Emeritus and Director Norman Ferber received total pay that was considered to be an outlier under our methodology. This was primarily due to the value of consulting fees he received under his consulting agreement. In the 2019 proxy, the company provided limited disclosure of Ferber's consulting services and the board's rationale for the large fees associated with the services. As a result, we determined that the company had not provided a reasonable rationale for the high director pay. However, in this year's proxy, the company provided significantly improved disclosure of Ferber's consulting activities, including specific activities Ferber conducted under his consulting agreement during fiscal 2019. This enhanced disclosure allowed shareholders to adequately assess Ferber's additional duties and their value to the company relative to the fees he was provided.
Well, I expect it's comforting for investors to know that some companies appear to be addressing problems not just for executive pay, but also for boardroom pay issues as well. Well, now, before we get into the pay numbers themselves, let's talk about the one topic that is obviously on everyone's mind, the impact of the coronavirus pandemic. Now, obviously, pay-related actions taken by boards in response to the pandemic will be a major focus for 2021 compensation disclosures. But how has the fallout from the economic downturn affected executive pay decisions thus far?
Well, like you said, David, the pandemic and its impact on executive pay will undoubtedly be the focal point of next year's proxy season. This is when companies disclose boardroom decisions made in 2020. You know, in many ways, the 2020 proxy season felt like a precursor to next year, and investors should be prepared for some companies making significant changes to pay programs and proxy disclosures in 2021. The most common and visible compensation committee response to the pandemic in the U.S. market so far has been many temporary base salary reductions for top executives. In addition, some companies have disclosed specific changes to incentive plans that cover the full gamut, from shifts in target goals to wholesale compensation structure overhauls. A large number of companies, however, have disclosed that they expect to make changes to incentive programs for 2020, although many companies have not announced what those changes might entail. Now, based on our early conversations with issuers, pay consultants, lawyers, and other market participants, we expect there may be an increase in one-time pay adjustments and the use of committee discretion in determining award payouts for 2020.
Okay, then. Well, it sounds like we'll have a lot of new disclosures to be on the lookout for next year. Thanks, Galen. I'm now going to turn to Brett, who has been crunching the 2019 pay numbers. Brett, what are some interesting aspects of executive pay that your team has been monitoring?
From an overall perspective, we're looking at how companies are going to manage the optics of their executive pay packages this year. They're going to need to be able to balance investors' expectations with internal workplace dynamics and the need to retain key personnel during this very volatile time. But it's so much more than just the total number. And the first thing that we're looking for are changes in the short-term cash versus long-term equity composition. Last year, the median CEO had 15% of pay delivered through short-term cash incentives. Significant changes may be used to recoup lost salary, and it may signal to investors that the compensation objectives have shifted, and they're going to focus on short-term survival rather than long-term value. And there's a few ways to tell what the primary objective is. One way that you could do this is by identifying companies who provided upward discretion in the short-term incentive program by looking for companies with value in the cash bonus as well as the non-equity incentive non-equity incentive payout column of the summary compensation table. In fiscal year 2019, roughly 6.5% of CEOs had cash bonuses in addition to their non-equity incentive payout. So we'll be looking to see if there is a increase. The next thing that you can look for are significant increases in perks. So, and that may be one way to offset any losses in base salary without it, and while also going under the radar. And then companies may that have similar values in the stock awards columns of the summary compensation table with significantly large increases in the number of shares granted, in particular, if multiple stock grants were made throughout the year. And then in terms of other interesting pay package decisions, I'm looking at it and the broader team and investor community overall, we're looking at for companies that are taking money under the CARES Act, how do these pay caps combined with changes in pension assumptions impact compensation decisions where there are potentially underfunded pension liabilities?
Yeah, that's a lot of areas, but are there any other compensation changes that your team expects to track?
Well, the first thing that we're looking for is materiality of these base salary reductions for executives that many companies have announced, and how long will these reductions persist? We've already identified 26 companies just in the last 30 days who have restored their executives' full salary, and we'll be watching closely to see if this corresponds with the end of furloughs and rehiring of previously laid off employees. The other thing that we're going to be looking at is peer group reconstruction, focusing on large companies and sectors who have been negatively impacted with peers who have been more resilient and or maybe even have thrived during this whole pandemic. Will asset divestitures and evolving business landscapes impact who companies compare themselves to? And then the last thing that we're really going to take a close watch on is the grants of plan-based award table. We will look at companies that granted in February very differently from companies granting in mid-March or even now. Companies who traditionally have one grant date per year will also be expected to explain to their shareholders why they made a secondary grant later in the year if they were made at the company's lowest point.
Okay, and Galen touched on this a bit earlier, but let me also pose this question to you, Brett. How might companies be altering incentive program design as a result of the pandemic?
It's a great question, and we expect to see a number of different goal changes in plan restructuring. 32% of the Russell 3000 use relative TSR in their long-term incentive plan for the CEO, at least last year. Companies may move from using this as a common base metric to more of a gate metric in 2020.
And just for the audience's benefit, could you briefly explain the difference between a base metric versus a gate metric?
Sure. A base metric is pretty simple. The board presents a goal or a set of goals with targets that directly lead to payout. If the company performs in the 50th percentile of its peers in TSR over the next 3 years, the CEO gets a number of shares or dollars. A gate metric, which is far less common, ensures that these base metrics don't pay out unless certain conditions are met. The idea that payouts require a strong relative or absolute TSR in order to ensure the primary metrics are aligned with shareholder returns is one that will be much more defensible from an investor relations perspective right now.
And why do you think investors may be less inclined to support the use of relative TSR as a metric right now?
Truthfully, I don't think anyone is overly eager to see relative TSR in incentive programs right now. If you had to rank what factors impacted stock price performance this year the most, and your choices are one, the CEO, two, COVID-19, or three, federal stimulus money, the CEO would probably rank last at most companies. Long-term investors may be willing to sacrifice short-term gains to secure the long-term future of the company. Next year, investors will be looking far more at how boards are going to drive or protect long-term value rather than if they protected it or drove it. On the flip side of this, from the CEO's perspective, assuming that market conditions beyond your control are fundamentally altering the stock price, more stable metrics within your control has a lot more appeal than relative TSR right now.
Okay, so we might see some pushback on the use of relative TSR, but what would be some pay metrics that you think both CEOs, boards, and investors may actually agree on?
Yeah, well, each company is going to have their own unique circumstances, and there's certainly no perfect one-size-fits-all metric. But the pandemic has really accelerated the focus on the S within the ESG framework. And you can expect that many investors will be focused on how the compensation program is driving company culture. So some of the heightened human capital focus will present itself in a tightening of pay ratio disclosures. But one of the ways that companies may look to show they're supporting their employee base and driving a strong culture through this difficult time is through the adoption of environmental and social metrics in the incentive program. Within our core executive compensation disclosure universe, roughly 18.5% of major companies in US, Canada, and Europe have adopted at least one ENS incentive metric, for at least for 2019. While much of this is in Europe, the US is almost double the percentage of companies compared to last year. They're now at 6%.
Okay, well, with this increased focus on ENS issues, can you talk about what types of ENS incentives that you foresee companies focusing on for next year?
Well, there are two culturally significant events going on in the US right now, and I think that will drive those what metrics are being used. The first is obviously the pandemic, and I expect a number of employee engagement and well-being metrics combined with employee safety and customer safety metrics. This is the most popular metric. Nearly 40% of companies with an ENS incentive currently use a safety metric, but they're usually in sectors with high workplace incident rates. You think utilities, materials, energy. It wouldn't surprise me to see more brick and mortar firms begin adopting them. You would maybe see supermarkets or maybe retail stores like Walmart, Target. And you actually might even see this in certain financial services firms, which would have been unthinkable a year ago. For the companies that have transitioned to remote working, you may see more of a focus on metrics that revolve around employee engagement. Moving on from that, the second culturally significant event that could impact incentives this year is the widespread protest over racial inequality. Today, roughly 4.5% of ENS short-term incentive metrics are related to diversity, and 6% of environmental and social long-term incentive metrics are related to diversity. You could reasonably see this taking the largest leap forward, as many individuals may look to influence racial injustices by investing their money in firms that focus on empowering and hiring underrepresented minorities.
Interesting. And how are you seeing investors thinking about company diversity or safety issues in connection with top executive pay?
Well, many investors are increasingly focused on this connection. Additionally, companies don't have to drive a payout and use base metrics with these goals. There's always the opportunity to use a gate, which we discussed earlier, or a modifier, which is going to adjust the payout of existing metrics based on their ability to enhance diversity, for example. Given the level of focus on these critical issues, having these types of incentives in the compensation program shows what the board is thinking about in terms of driving the company forward and what they want the CEO to be focused on. Rarely does a single metric dominate the entire short-term incentive program, as a CEO is required to balance a lot of competing priorities, both in the short-term and the long-term. But investors are increasingly expecting strong disclosure and action from companies in addressing these critical issues. And one way boards can ensure this is through the compensation plan.
Okay, well, thank you, Brett. Very interesting points for investors to be thinking about. And lastly, I'd like to now turn our attention over to the Canadian proxy season. Rashima, what did the Canadian market see in terms of the number of say and pay proposals and their voting support?
So unlike prior years where we saw an increasing trend, interestingly, into 2020 so far, the total number of say on pay votes submitted for shareholder approval has slightly decreased. Now this drop could also be attributable to the number of canceled or postponed meetings that we have seen due to the pandemic. This year, a total of 189 Canadian companies held such votes, as compared to 194 companies in 2019 during the same period. We anticipate that the number of say-on-pay votes will still increase in the near future, depending on the effective date of the amendment proposed by the federal government that would require certain companies that are incorporated under the Canada Business Corporations Act to hold such say-on-pay votes on an annual basis. In terms of the voting results, improved compensation practices in Canada have led to zero failed say-on-pay votes so far this year. In fact, the average support levels has increased to 93% of the votes, which is up from 91% in 2019 over the same comparable time period. there was only one company, Vermilion Energy Incorporated, that received less than 70% support in 2020. And this company did not have any alarming compensation concerns, except that we saw an increase of 40% in CEO's base salary for the second consecutive year, and the company had poor shareholder returns. Interestingly, recently, the company announced the departure of its CEO, Marino.
Well, I'm certainly glad to hear that we're seeing some improvements in compensation practices in Canada. What about the quantum of CEO pay or any other pay trends worth highlighting in that market?
Yes, indeed. There are a couple of developments worth mentioning here. First, in 2019, the government announced changes in the taxation of options in the Canadian market to bring them more in line with the US regime, which delineates the tax treatment of qualified versus the non-qualified stock option grants. However, later in 2019, in December, the government announced that the proposed changes to the tax treatment would not come into force as expected on January 1st, 2020. Now, since this postponement was announced late in 2019, some companies actually doubled up on stock option grants in 2019 itself before the anticipated tax changes. These efforts to beat the expected deadline led to an elevated pay for performance concern level based on our quantitative model. However, these companies clearly indicated in their circulars that these outsized option grants were meant to cover both fiscal 2019 as well as 2020, with no annual option grants that will be made this year. In terms of the CEO pay quantum, the median CEO total compensation at the top TSX composite index companies increased by 5% year over year. Around 30% of these CEOs received more than $1 million Canadian dollars as base salary, and approximately 15% of CEOs' total granted compensation was more than 10 million Canadian dollars. We also noticed that one-time awards, such as new hire awards, retention awards, they're becoming more common in the market. We also noticed the enhanced disclosure. So the disclosure about the rationales for granting such awards has improved. The companies are now providing more details about the vesting provision, the performance conditions, if applicable.
Okay, and Rashima, obviously this is an international pandemic and we are going to see impacts across the globe. But can you speak to what changes in compensation practices you have seen or expect to see in Canada?
So thus far, it's very similar to what we've seen in US market. We saw a number of companies that have adopted executive salary cuts, 100% salary waivers, and or reduction in director compensation, particularly the cash retainers, as a result of the impact of COVID-19. Most of the 2019 fiscal year payouts were made before the pandemic, and hence nothing substantial was noted pertaining to bonus payouts for fiscal 2019. In terms of the long-term incentives, there was one composite index company called Seabridge Gold. They submitted a repricing proposal. Specifically, the company's option terms were extended as the vesting conditions, which were subject to completion of a joint venture transaction, were potentially disrupted by the pandemic. Also looking ahead, we would not be surprised to see a resurgence of option exchange programs in Canada. The Canadian government also introduced the Large Employer Emergency Financing Facility Program. This program is open to large for-profit businesses with revenues over $300 million or higher. With the exception of those in the financial sector, as well as certain not-for-profit businesses. Now, while the loan is outstanding, the borrower is subject to strict limits on dividends, share buybacks, and there are certain restrictions on executive compensation as well, although the details have not been made public yet. In addition, interestingly, the loan recipient companies will be required to commit to publish annual climate-related disclosure reports, which is consistent with the Financial Stability Board's Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures. including how their future operations will support environmental sustainability and national climate goals. The reports will highlight how corporate governance strategies, policies, and companies' practices will help to manage climate-related risk and opportunities and contribute to achieving Canada's commitments under the Paris Agreement and goal of net zero by 2050.
Okay, well, thank you, Rashima. A lot of interesting things happening in the Canadian market as well, it sounds like. Well, with that, we have reached the conclusion of our US and Canada proxy season compensation recap. I would like to thank Galen, Brett, and Rashima for their contributions, and I'd also like to thank our listeners for tuning in. I hope you've enjoyed this latest installment of our ISS Proxy Bulletin podcast series. And please do send any feedback or questions you may have to bulletin@issgovernance.com. Okay, stay safe and goodbye for now.